Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A UN contractor, a truck driver, reportedly used a Kalashnikov rifle to help fight off Taliban fighters as they stormed that UN guest house in Kabul, Afghanistan this morning. The militants killed at least a dozen people, including an American, before they were killed. The Taliban also launched rocket attacks on the presidential palace and a luxury hotel. In neighboring Pakistan, another car bomb attack killed at least 90 people today during Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit to that country. All this as the New York Times reports today that the Obama administration is considering a shift in strategy in the region. Tom Shanker covers the Pentagon and national security for the Times. Tom, so what is the Obama administration considering in its shift in strategy?
Well, as part of their new strategy review that will end up deciding whether and how many more troops will be added to the mission is a proposal from the commander in Kabul, General Stanley A. McChrystal, to focus on protecting the population. Now, this is a central tenet of counterinsurgency strategy, to separate the population from the insurgents who intimidate them and all of the corruption and pressure. And the argument goes that if the population feels secure, they will then support the central government. The country will grow and stabilize. But it's kind of a risky strategy in some ways, because by focusing the limited number of troops only on the major population centers, you're in effect surrendering vast swaths of the countryside to the insurgency.
Well, and that seems to be the shift, because we understood that the thinking was protect the population, but it seemed to be in more far-flung regions.
That's exactly right. You might recall from Vietnam, there's this idea of strategic hamlets where individual villages were protected by troops. What we found in Afghanistan, though, is that these far-flung remote outposts are really just bullet magnets. They are subject to attack, and General McChrystal has decided that they really don't bring a lot of security to the population by having several hundred troops protecting very small pockets of the population. Instead, the lesson is drawn from the surge in Iraq, where all the extra forces went to the major cities to protect the major population centers. There's one shift for Afghanistan, though. General McChrystal wants to include in this idea of population centers the vital infrastructure that supports the quality of life. So he's looking at a couple of the more fertile agricultural areas, a couple of the industrial belts, and the major highway systems that link Afghanistan cities as well as the country to neighboring Pakistan and Iran. If he gets that full request, that really means a significant number of new troops. I think that's one of the things that they're trying to debate right now.
Well, and that's interesting, because you wrote the debate is no longer over whether to send more troops, but how many.
I think that's exactly right. At a minimum, President Obama even has support from the Democrats in Congress to add a brigade or two of trainers. The argument there being that, you know, as the Afghan security forces step up, the Americans can step back. So I think it is pretty safe to say there will be some additional troops added beyond the 21,000 already ordered there by President Obama. The real question is, how fully will they embrace a population-centric counterinsurgency strategy? And if so, how many more brigades will be assigned to which cities, which highway systems, which agricultural and industrial areas? That's where the debate is right now.
And is the thinking that other parts of the country that are less populated would just be ceded to the Taliban? I know you quote Senator John Kerry saying some of these areas don't need U.S. troops. They're already hostile to the Taliban.
There's sort of a combination. In the north, the Taliban insurgency really aren't that strong. There are parts because of ethnic and tribal reasons the insurgency has no roots, but there are also areas where the insurgency is in no way a threat to the United States or even a threat to the government in Kabul. The insurgencies are because of tribal anger among tribes or because of logging or smuggling or just criminal elements. And where there really is a politically motivated insurgency, the argument now goes, we can let them wither, we can isolate them, that if they don't have access to major population centers, they are not an immediate threat. I mean, this is really an important decision now, because what it says is that the American military is never going to kill off the insurgency, but they need to sort of, you know, throttle back its oxygen for long enough to let the Afghans take over that mission.
Obama would seem to now be disappointing his supporters on the left, who wanted him to pull out, and even critics on the right, like George Will, who want him to pull out of Afghanistan.
I think there is a certain, everybody gets a little bit if this is where they end up, because protecting the cities is something everybody can appreciate. Letting the strategy be strict counterterrorism, you know, in the empty spaces is kind of what Biden wanted. So this actually may be sort of shaping up as a grand bargain so that everybody in the debate can say, hey, we got a little something.
Tom Shanker of The New York Times. Tom, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Tip O'Neill, the late Speaker of the House, called Social Security the third rail of American politics. Touch it and watch out for angry elderly voters. Well, Medicare is the new third rail, but will propose changes to cut $500 billion in 10 years, enhance coverage for most by cutting waste, or diminish coverage for many. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell warned last week that these are major cuts with serious consequences, but the New York Times editorializes that Republicans are scaremongering and it's time to call them to account. Well, we want to find out about that, but also ask what exactly is Medicare. We want to get a primer from Stuart Altman. He's professor of health policy at Brandeis University's Heller School. He's been advising presidents since Nixon. President Clinton appointed him to the Bipartisan Commission on Medicare. He also advised the Obama transition on health care. Stuart, professor, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Robin.
And get right to it. What exactly is Medicare?
Well, Medicare in its simplest form, but it's not very simple, is basically it's made up of four parts. Part A, which we're all familiar with, we pay our taxes each month when we're working, and a trust fund is set up, and that's what provides us if we need hospital care or extended care in a nursing home or a rehab. Part B pays for our physician services, and it pays for outpatient care in general. That is paid for by a combination of premiums that everyone who, and it's voluntary, you don't have to belong, but 95% of people who are on Part A, by the way, Part A, everyone belongs who have paid in.
Automatically.
Part B, you have to choose, but as I said, everyone chooses.
And you get a little extra coverage. Yep.
And you get definitely extra coverage, and it includes a lot, but it's primarily for outpatient care, physician care, drugs. Now, then we've created Part C and D. Part C, which we'll talk about in a minute, is this Medicare Advantage, and I know you want to spend time on
that. Yeah, put that aside. That's
and
controversial.
Medicare Part D, which was the newest addition, pays for prescription drugs. It's a complicated program. People have to sign up with private insurance, and then the government supports them. And it's that infamous donut hole that sits there.
Let me just jump in with the donut hole, because we were so proud of ourselves. We managed to thrash through this morning. The donut hole, it requires that participants only pay a copay until between them and the insurer, they've spent a little over $2,500. Then comes the donut hole, during which participants pay the full amount until they've paid as much as $3,200 or so in a full amount for their prescription drugs. Then after that, the insurance company takes over pretty much all the payments. They hardly have any copay. Did I get the donut right?
I think you did it right. I think the numbers on the high side are higher than that. But
right.
I think you got it right. And it's a complicated plan, and it would take me a long time to explain who in the world created that and why it was created. But that's essentially right.
Okay. But let's go back to C. And by the way, also just in an overarching way, Medicare is for the elderly. Medicaid, as opposed to Medicaid, which is primarily for the poor, the indigent children.
And one other thing I would say that there are some people that are both on Medicare and Medicaid.
Right.
They're called dual eligible. So if you're very poor and you're over 65, and I would say one other thing, there are a few other people who qualify for Medicare. If you're suffering from end-stage renal disease, renal program, you qualify for Medicare even if you're under 65. And there are certain disabled who qualify for Medicare.
Okay. Medicare Advantage. This is where the huge controversy is. This is where the cuts are planned. What is Medicare Advantage?
Medicare Advantage was set up in the mid-1980s. It allows people to sign up with private insurance, managed care companies. It's gone through three iterations. They changed the name of it. But essentially, it allows people to opt out of traditional Medicare, get their benefits from a managed care company, and then the government pays the managed care company.
The idea was it would give the government some competition by using these private companies.
Yes, and there have been, and there is arguments in favor of them, because some of these plans do coordination of care and provide extra benefits. They do a more efficient way of providing care. And so many people who are traditionally been in managed care, whether you worked for insured by Kaiser on the West Coast or Tufts Health Plan here in the Boston area, you know, you just traditionally move when you enter Medicare, you can just take that on.
Okay. So the Obama White House and Democrats in Congress are talking about making cuts specifically to Medicare Advantage. What's the debate over Medicare Advantage? What's perceived as the problem with it?
Well, beginning in 1997, the Congress began to add extra funding for certain areas that are on Medicare Advantage. We have a very this country is broken up into many different places, and in some places the spending on Medicare is much lower than in others. And the ones where it was spending was low, like in rural areas or on the West Coast in Seattle and Portland, they wanted more money for Medicare Advantage. And so Medicare Advantage payments from the government began to exceed what Medicare traditionally pays for the same people. And so
there's a number there.
It averages around 14% to 15%.
More.
More. And in some places, it's as much as 30% more.
And why? What do Medicare Advantage participants, again, they pay a little extra in addition to their premiums, their Medicare B. What do they get extra?
Well, the fair assessment is the critics of this say, well, all it does is go to the insurance companies. That's totally not true. Yes, the insurance companies in some cases do, and it may be many cases, make more as a result of that. But a lot of it goes to Medicare extra benefits. It goes for reduced or eliminated premiums. You talked about the donut hole. Some of these Medicare Advantage plans fill in that donut hole. It goes for some extra benefits here and there. But for the most part, it fills in lower premiums, low copayments, and extra benefits, particularly on the drug side.
And they get other extra benefits, like, for instance, hearing aids at times. We read health club memberships.
Yes, they do. I mean, the health club memberships are, you know, sound like a fancy thing, but they're designed to keep people healthy.
Sure. So bring us to the heart of the debate. The Democrats say that in making some cuts to Medicare Advantage, they can take some of that money and fund more benefits for people in general Medicare.
Yeah, well, the basic argument in favor of the cuts are two. One is why is that because we pay so much more, there are Medicare Advantage plans that really are not doing that much. They're able to provide all these extra benefits and not do good things like coordination of care and a more efficient system. That's not true of all of them, but that's argument number one. Argument number two is why should Medicare pay for more benefits for just some population? And by the way, we're talking about 11 million or 25% of all Medicare people
right.
are now under the Medicare Advantage.
Well, according to the Leadership Council of Aging, they say that everyone in Medicare pays around $3 a month extra to subsidize the Medicare Advantage plan. So everybody, you're shaking your head, maybe no?
Some of that extra money gets built into the Part B premium. And so I guess there is some. Most of it is coming out of either general tax money or the trust fund.
Well, so again, there's the question of is it fair that there are some seniors who get these extra benefits if, in fact, maybe the playing field could be made a little more even if there were some cuts made. Of course, seniors who get those benefits and pay for them and feel that they've helped them live longer and healthier lives are outraged that they may be taken away. We're going to continue our look at the battle over Medicare with Stuart Altman of Brandeis University. When we come back, some solutions, some suggestions. We'll see not everybody is happy. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're getting a primer in Medicare from Stuart Altman, a professor of health policy at Brandeis University's Heller School. He has an extensive resume in Washington. He knows of what he speaks. He has worked for presidents on both sides of the aisle, advised them about government health insurance programs. And Stuart, we had just explained this, as we said, the new third rail of health care reform, which is has sort of focused on Medicare Advantage. This is a part of the Medicare program that millions of seniors pay into, and it gives them a little extra benefits. But now there's talk in health care reform of making some cuts. And we mentioned a New York Times editorial that talks about Medicare, what they call Medicare scaremongering. They say that that these cuts would make Medicare better for more people by enhancing drug coverage, reducing premiums, eliminating co-pays, say, for preventive services, and helping to keep Medicare solvent. What's your view of whether or not cuts have to be made in Medicare Advantage?
Well, I think it's fair to say that to the extent that the funds that are being cut from Medicare Advantage do go back into the Medicare program, and there are cases where it does go, there's going to be some improvements in the drug benefits, the three things, the times. But most of the money in the cuts are going to go to support the coverage for people not on Medicare. Now, that doesn't say that this is not fair. Of course, fairness is in the eye of the beholder. And for those people on Medicare Advantage, they will see a cut in benefits. For most people on Medicare, it will either improve their situation or at least leave it alone. And yes, it will put off for a little while, a very little while, the problem we're going to have in funding Medicare. It will not solve the Medicare problem.
Well, we want to ask you about the solvency of Medicare, but first, just what cuts do you foresee happening in Medicare Advantage? We mentioned that they may lose benefits like hearing aids or health club memberships. As you said, those aren't frills, you know.
Well, I think it's more than – I think it's the premiums and the extra drugs. I think it depends critically on what part of the country you're in and what the difference is in the plan that you go. For some plans that have been relying on these extra payments are getting 20 to 30% more and really aren't doing very much for it, the cuts are going to be very significant. For those plans that are in urban areas or in plans that really know how to manage care – if these cuts are phased in over time and they're not too draconian, I think the impact on benefits will be very small.
Well, Bill Nelson, the Democratic senator from Florida, is pushing an amendment that would preserve Medicare Advantage programs and benefits in states where plans cost the government less than traditional Medicare. This is because so many people are in the plan, and that includes his state, you know, Florida. Almost a million seniors on the plan, but then that would leave out seniors in, you know, North Dakota.
Well, to be fair, one of the reasons why he can propose that is that the cost of traditional Medicare in Florida is off the charts.
Yeah.
So if you compare what they get in Florida for traditional Medicare to what they get in Seattle, it's probably a 40% difference. So they can afford to have Medicare payments on their Medicare Advantage and still do all right. But in other parts of the country, they can't.
Well, and then here's other things that critics say. They say, first of all, if we start cutting away at Medicare Advantage, some companies that carry Medicare Advantage, these commercial insurers that work with the government, these private insurers, may drop it. And also, Gail Walensky, who ran Medicare under President George H.W. Bush, says another problem is that many places like nursing homes depend on extra revenue, not just from Medicare, but from Medicare Advantage, to subsidize the patients who don't have it.
I think she's correct, and it's not only that. It's also certain physician groups that depend upon the capitated payments from Medicare Advantage. Again, I think what's critical isn't so much that we're going to have cuts. It's that these cuts are phased in and that they're not so draconian that they cause substantial disruption. The idea of leaving a 15% differential, I think, is off the table. I think it's just a question 15% extra money going to
Medicare Advantage.
I think that fairness dictates that be cut back. It's how we do it and how tough those cuts are.
Right. A couple questions for you, Stuart Altman. You say the big question is whether Medicare is sustainable in the long run. Is it?
I think the answer is yes, but it will need changes. I want to make it very clear. I have a conflict of interest. I'm on Medicare. I want it to continue.
Let me bring up the next question, which is a lot of people say, professor at Brandeis probably does fairly okay. Will we have to start looking at who gets Medicare, that it may not be for all seniors?
I believe in the concept of social insurance. I do believe that people of higher income can pay more. And by the way, let's be very clear. I am doing okay, thank you. And I having a job at my age. But as a result, are paying twice as much for my Medicare Part B as people who have low income.
Right.
We are already income-relating Medicare. And I think that's okay. But I don't think we should say and make Medicare totally an income-related program. The fact that we have a social insurance program is key to Medicare, and I would hate to see that be destroyed.
Well, and what do you think, finish your thought about what you would like to see?
Well, at the end, what we need is we need a combination of things. There is no question that going forward, whether it's 5 years from now or 8 years from now, we're going to need a combination of more money into Medicare, and we're going to need Medicare to change the way it pays for care and to develop a more efficient system. Medicare, with as much as I have support for it, does not pay correctly, and there's a lot of waste in Medicare, so that we need to change Medicare. Medicare is not broken, but Medicare has problems. And if we don't do that, if we live with the same income and continue to pay the same way, then we are going to have a serious crisis.
And I just want to say, when you say waste, you're not talking about health club memberships for the elderly. You're talking about fraud.
Well, I'm talking about two things. I mean, we combine waste and fraud. Fraud should be stopped. Second, waste is when we do things inappropriately, and we could do it better by doing for less.
Yeah, like when I had to spirit my mom out of the hospital because she was going to get about 10 procedures she didn't need.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's Stuart Altman, professor of health policy at Brandeis University's Heller School. Stuart, thanks so much, as always.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Robin.
Take a second to let you know, tomorrow we're going to take a look at a new documentary that remembers the late actor John Cazale. You remember him in The Deer Hunter, Dog Day Afternoon? How about Fredo in The Godfather? We will remember this extraordinary actor tomorrow. Still ahead today, a conversation about civil commitment. What does it mean here and now?
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. Welcome back to Here and Now. Okay, we're all getting used to saying Turnpike Series. People living between Pennsylvania and New York along the New Jersey Turnpike are trying to decide Yankees, Phillies, Phillies, Yankees, as the series travels back and forth between Philly and the Bronx starting tonight when the defending World Series champion Philadelphia Phillies take on the New York Yankees, who won 103 games this past season. Ben Ryder is covering the games for Sports Illustrated. Ben, for the last few years, we've had Cinderella teams make it to the series, the Tampa Bay Rays in 2008, the Colorado Rockies in 2007. This year, two marquee matchups. So first of all, get me excited about this. Why should I be?
There's little question, Robin, that these are the two premier teams in baseball right now. We've got, what's without a doubt, the best National League team in the Phillies, the best American League team in the Yankees. Both clubs boast powerful offenses. This will be the first time since 1927 that the World Series will feature each league's team leader in home runs and runs scored. And another thing to get excited about is that we're going to see some of the premier pitchers in the league three times each, possibly. Talking about the Yankees ace CC Sabathia and the Phillies ace Cliff Lee. Now, these guys have a lot in common. They're former teammates on the Cleveland Indians. Both are left-handed. Both are former Cy Young Award winners. And they should match up against each other potentially three times in Wednesday night's Game 1, in Game 4, and in Game 7 if it gets that far.
Okay, I'm a little excited. Game 2, we'll see the former Boston Red Sox pitcher, Pedro Martinez, our former love here in Boston. But, in fact, he's made it to the postseason six times, but always with the Red Sox. Now he's with the Phillies, and he'll be matched up with A.J. Burnett of the Yankees. That's again in Game 2. But, you know, you've got all this hyperbole, all these great hitters, great pitchers, great teams. Does that sort of raise the bar? They better be great games.
Absolutely. And Pedro Martinez, as you mentioned, is without a doubt a key here. He's taken to calling himself the old goat during this postseason, but he certainly hasn't been pitching like that so far. And his acquisition by the general manager Ruben Amaro of the Phillies is a big reason why they've gotten this far, and is a big reason why they have a chance even against a team as powerful and as rich and as loaded like the Yankees.
And is hated in some quarters. I can say that. I'm from New York originally. Well, then you've got the two other characters, the stadiums, the new Yankee Stadium in the Bronx and Citizens Bank Park in Philly. How are they going to play a role?
Well, both these places are considered launching pads in baseball parlance, particularly Yankee Stadium. Short right field porch. The Yankees have had little trouble poking balls over that wall all season long. And the Phillies, of course, with great sluggers like Ryan Howard, should have little trouble as well. One key for the Yankees, in my mind, is that Mark Teixeira really gets things going, the first baseman for the Yankees. He's struggled a bit in the postseason. He's hitting only .205, which is way below how he performed during the regular season when he emerged as a real MVP candidate in the American League. So he's going to have to heat up a little bit here, and I think perhaps playing in these band boxes might just be the thing to do it.
These little band boxes, these little jewel boxes, these small stadiums. So a lot of home runs. It's always fun. And the fans, they're both East Coast teams, fans from vibrant cities that, how shall we say it, have a colorful approach to their cheering.
You're absolutely right about that. You mentioned the New Jersey Turnpike. I'm also interested to see what's going to happen on the Amtrak train lines between New York and Philadelphia over the next week or so. I think that in a normal case, Alex Rodriguez is a player on whom the Philadelphia fans could really, you know, kind of ride, who they could maybe put him off his game a little bit.
Of course, this is A-Rod, the huge hitter for the Yankees.
Of course, but you know, he's had his postseason struggles in the past, but it seems to be almost in a zen-like state this October. All he says is, I'm seeing the ball, I'm hitting the ball. He's having one of the greatest offensive postseasons anyone's ever had so far. So I don't think that the Philly fans will be able to put him off his game too much.
But they will try.
They certainly will.
That's Ben Ryder of Sports Illustrated getting us ready for the World Series, which starts tonight. Ben, thanks so much.
Should be an all-time fall classic, really.
Something tells me we're going to hear a lot about people's mothers and their shoe wear, you know, combat boots and such. I'm a New Yorker, I can say that, here and now. What should be done with convicted sex offenders who've done their jail time and yet raise concerns that they may reoffend? Well, since the late 90s, more and more states are turning to civil commitment. While it's being questioned for federal prisoners in a case before the Supreme Court, it is legal for states to keep sex offenders confined after they've done their time. And here in Massachusetts, a district attorney is asking the state to adjust the law so that juries, rather than judges, decide whether someone should be civilly committed. This after a judge released did not civilly recommit a convicted offender, despite pleas from the prosecutor. That offender went on to attack a woman 5 days after his release. Well, today we just want to get an introduction to civil commitments with someone involved in deciding who gets them. Dr. Anna Salter is a psychologist. She consults with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. She evaluates sex offenders for civil commitment. Dr. Salter, we know there are also civil commitment laws for people, for instance, who are mentally ill and might be a danger to themselves or others. But how many states have civil commitment laws for sex offenders, and what are the general requirements?
20 states now have civil commitment laws for sex offenders, and the laws are pretty similar from state to state. A sex offender, to be eligible, has to have a diagnosis that leads him to reoffend sexually. For example, schizophrenia would not suffice typically, because schizophrenia doesn't cause people to commit sex offenses, whereas pedophilia would suffice. He also, or she, has to be more likely than not in most states to reoffend. There's usually some kind of risk level that's included in the law. And he has to have, in most places, serious difficulty in controlling his urge to reoffend.
And we understand that one of the reasons that states started using these civil commitment programs was the hope of treating people while in jail so that they could be released and possibly helped.
Well, that's controversial. Certainly that's what some people believe. Critics of the law say that the law was simply intended to keep them off the street. But what is actually built into the law is treatment, that you treat them and they aren't released until they've lowered the risk to reoffend.
Well, and critics say the majority aren't released. They stay in civil commitment because some treatments don't work.
Well, I don't know if the treatments don't work, but the truth is when you're detaining the top 10% of high-risk sex offenders, it's really not a surprise to me that not all of them are able to lower their risk to reoffend.
Right. You're part of a review process.
Well, it's more than a review. It's an actual trial. For example, I do civil commitment evaluations. I've done a couple for the federal government, but I've done 60 in all for different states, particularly the state of Iowa. And while there are minor differences between states, the bottom line is that it typically takes more than one evaluation to refer them for civil commitment, and it goes to a trial, and the offender has the opportunity to defend himself fully and make the claim that he does not meet criteria, and of course the prosecution is claiming that he does.
And then how is it reviewed down the road?
That differs depending on the states. In some states, it's an automatic review every year, for example. In other states, the offender has to apply for a review after X amount of time. But there is a built-in review process.
Well, in your reviews at the front end, as someone is being considered for civil commitment, how often do you conclude that they should be civilly committed?
Well, in my experience, it's been about half the time, but you have to remember that's not half of the sex offenders, because the only sex offenders who are being referred to me are high-risk sex offenders. When they come to me, there has already been a screening process that probably lets out about 90% of sex offenders.
Well, we know that you're not here as a defender of sex offenders, but can you explain that to people who, you know, are reacting to these stories we hear across the country, and they don't think that anyone who is considered a serious offender should be released? We know there are people like Andrew Vash. He once made the symbolic suggestion that all pedophiles should be held on an island simply because they're untreatable. So can you just briefly explain to people how is it that someone might not go to civil commitment as opposed to how is it that they do?
Well, I think the public has the idea that all sex offenders are the same and that they're all high-risk offenders. But study after study after study after study all come to the same conclusion, and that is there's a range of sex offenders. There are sex offenders who have a 4% chance of reoffending, and there are sex offenders who have a 76% chance of reoffending within the first 10 years. Nobody hears about the ones who do not reoffend. So if you get one reoffense, everybody thinks that's typical of sex offenders. But it's really not true. Secondly, the problem with retaining all of them is we would have to choose between funding our universities and funding our prisons. When you are paying in some states close to $100,000 per offender per year for civil commitment, every 10 offenders is $1 million. To say that we could now also incarcerate the 90% of sex offenders who aren't high risk and add them to those budget figures, I don't think people understand the impact that would have.
Is there anything to be done to make sure that those most likely to recidivate are held in civil commitment?
I think the process is pretty good because we have new instruments in the last few years which predict with much greater accuracy who is likely to reoffend and who isn't. I think the process for getting them in is pretty good. It's a lot more difficult to determine when they've made the changes that would cause you to release them.
One last question. Here in Massachusetts, there's a move to switch consideration of civil commitment at the beginning from a judge to a jury. The Middlesex County Attorney General here thinks that juries are going to be much tougher, more likely to send people to civil commitment than judges. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I testify in front of judges and juries, and I've been surprised. Both judges and juries are fairly tough to get past. They don't take depriving someone's civil liberties lightly.
That's really interesting because when you hear these stories, the children in particular who disappear, there's such public outrage that you'd think that that would transfer to a jury. But you're saying that even juries, too, you've seen sort of stop short and reconsider, do I want to literally sentence someone twice for the same crime, which is what civil commitment is.
Yeah, that's right. And the victim isn't there, and the offender is. And if they look presentable and talk well, that has an enormous impact on juries. But you must remember, everybody's afraid most of all of the killers. And 60% of sadistic killers have no criminal record. So it's not like we're going to stop all of this. the horrible stuff that goes on by focusing entirely on repeat sex offenders. The majority of serial killers don't have a prior record.
Dr. Anna Salter, psychologist who consults with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections and also evaluates sex offenders for civil commitment for the federal government. On that very somber note, Dr. Salter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And remember, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
The termite. Some primal termite knocked on wood and tasted it and found it good. And that is why your cousin May fell through the parlor floor today.
That's Ogden Nash reading his poem, The Termite, on the CD that comes with a new book of poems for kids and their parents. The book connects poetry and science to illustrate Darwin's theory of evolution. It's called The Tree That Time Built, a celebration of nature, science, and imagination.
Do not fret and do not doubt. You are in time. You can't fall out. No matter what you say or do, you are in time. Time is in you. And everything that is to be will be in time upon this tree.
The poems were selected by, and some, like that one, written by, the U.S. Children's Poet Laureate. She's Mary Ann Hoberman, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by her collaborator, Linda Winston, a cultural anthropologist and teacher. Linda, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Mary Ann, first of all, who knew there was a Children's Poet Laureate?
Not many people, I guess. It's brand new.
And that poem that we heard, The Tree That Time Built, the book is of the same name, is yours. What are you trying to say in that poem? You know, do not fret, do not doubt. You are in time. You can't fall out.
I don't know exactly what it means, even though I wrote it. I don't even remember who said it. This person said, you can't fall out of time. And ever since then, I heard it many years ago, I've clung to this. It's one of my mantras. Terrible things can happen, but you can't fall out of time. And so I wrote this little verse, and then it seemed to fit so beautifully.
Well, and it seems like a perfect thing to say to a child who might be thinking, how is it that I stay on this earth, which I'm learning is a circle and spinning around?
Exactly.
You know, you can't fall out of time.
You can't fall out of time.
But, Linda, I have to ask you, it's a beautiful book. It comes with an audio CD filled with some of the poems, and there are also comments at the bottom of the page, we want to get to that, that track parallels between poems and science. But we understand that it is about the evolution of life. Charles Darwin might be a central character. And we just have to ask you about this because, you know, we're marking the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, as only 39% of Americans believe in his theory of evolution. Were you thinking about that when you were putting this together for kids?
I had the feeling, and she did too, of course, that evolution was going to be falling on hard times in the public school districts in many states. And I felt and said to her, you're one of the few people who can make an important difference now. All you need to do is collect 15 or 20 of the poems you've already written, and we'll write some prose links that will show how they're connected to Darwin's concepts. And at that point, Marianne recited a poem.
Is this Anthropoids?
Yes, it is.
Well, actually, let's hear a little bit of Anthropoids.
When I write my poems, I often am influenced by cadences and by rhythms. And Rudyard Kipling, who is one of the great writers for children and wrote the Just So stories, How the Elephant Got His Trunk, How the Camel Got His Hump, he wrote a poem at the end of each of these stories. And at the end of How the Camel Got His Hump, he wrote, the camel's hump is an ugly lump, which well you may see at the zoo, but uglier yet is the hump we get from having too little to do. Kitties and grown-ups too, ooh-ooh, when they haven't enough to do, ooh-ooh, we get the hump, the camellia's hump, the hump that is black and blue. Well, that rhythm wouldn't leave me until I wrote my own poem, which is called Anthropoids. And anthropoid means manlike. And here's this poem. This is really how the book started. The next time you go to the zoo, slow down for a minute or two and consider the apes. all their sizes and shapes, for they all are related to you, yes, they all are related to you, and they all are related to me, to our fathers and mothers, our sisters and brothers, and all of the people we see. The chimpanzees, gorillas, and all the orangutans climbing the wall, these remarkable creatures share most of our features, and the difference between us is small. And this book is my dream anthology. This is what I would have loved to have had when I was a child.
Here's just some samplings. A poem that I really liked is Adam from Adam by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Mm-hmm. It reads, Adam from Adam yawns as far as moon from earth, as star from star. And when he wrote that, no one really knew what matter was.
No, in our comment on that, we point that out. But that's what is so remarkable about poets, that they often anticipate scientific discoveries that will come later on.
Yeah. Here are some others. Marianne, have written a poem about bees, but so did Emily Dickinson. The pedigree of honey. The pedigree of honey does not concern the bee. A clover, any time to him, is aristocracy.
Yeah.
But that lets you explain to children what pollination is.
Yes, yes, yes.
The Polar Bear by Jack Proletsky. The polar bear, by being white, gives up his camouflage at night, and yet, without a thought or care, he wanders here, meanders there, and gaily treads the icy floes, completely unconcerned with foes. For after dark, nobody dares to set out after polar bears.
Here's another one, Yokoyayu's A Discovery. A discovery. On my frog's smooth green belly, there sits no button.
I know. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Valerie Wirth has flies. Flies where their bones on the outside, it begins.
Yeah.
Why is it that we think that poetry has nothing to do with science and science has nothing to do with poetry? Linda, you want to take a stab at that?
Each one of them, I think, seems to be a mysterious kind of mountain to climb. I've worked with lots and lots of teachers and kids, and for sure the concepts in evolution are complex, but it isn't fair to think that they're not able to be understood if they're properly presented. And poets very often do that. There's a wonderful poem about a frog that Marianne has in this collection, and when I showed the book to our biologist friend, she fixed on that poem and she said, this poem is science. It's many different branches of science, line by line.
Let's listen.
Frog. Polly wiggle, polly wog, tadpole, bullfrog, leaps on long legs, jugger-rum, jelly eggs, sticky tongue, tricks flies, spied by flicker eyes, wet skin, cold blood, squats in mucky mud, leaps on long legs, jugger-rum, jelly eggs, late in wet bog, polly wiggle, polly wog.
Fun. That is the U.S. Children's Poet Laureate Mary Ann Hoberman, together with cultural anthropologist Linda Winston. They've put together the book, The Tree That Time Built, A Celebration of Nature, Science, and Imagination. As we said, it also comes with a CD. Couple last ones, Just Living. Linda, you read this on the CD. Could you read it for us? It's Hans Christian Andersen. It's on page 68.
Just living is not enough, said the butterfly. One must have sunshine, freedom, and a little flower.
What a wonderful thing to tell children. I want to close with Christine O'Connell George reading her Old Elm Speaks. What a wonderful message to give to kids. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It is, as I told you, young sapling, it will take autumns of patience before you snag your first moon.